How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Figure Four Daily. It is September 13th, 2011 here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. We are joined today by Chris Masters. We have a ton of stuff to talk about today with Chris. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing my bad. How are you?
Not too bad. I was just watching some Superstars matches on YouTube that you were involved in, including some stuff from your feud with Tyler Rex. And when you were released, one of the things that a lot of people brought up was the fact that a lot of people haven't seen Chris Masters lately. He's been wrestling on Superstars, but he has improved dramatically. And in fact, you had. It was actually funny because, you know, it's one thing when you see a guy in a match with somebody that's renowned as a great worker and that sort of thing. But, you know, no offense to Tyler Rex or anything, but you were in there having great matches with Tyler Rex. And it was pretty impressive. And I guess that's the first question here. Obviously, from your early days in WWE until the end when you got released, you made some big improvements. Was there anything that happened in your life that really, was there something that clicked in your head, or what led to all that improvement?
Well, I think a number of things happened. You know, when I came back in 2009, you know, I realized after a few months in that they had no incentive to really do anything or use me. They just kind of hired me back. But also, you know, I'd always heard the criticism from back in my first stint about how, you know, this is a body guy, he can't go in the ring. And, you know, I heard all that criticism, and, I always kind of took it to heart because I was never a bodybuilder who turned and, you know, went into professional wrestling. I always loved pro wrestling and sports entertainment. And, you know, I looked up to the guys like Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart and Kurt Hennig. I mean, you know, like when I was a kid, you could see the difference between the guys who could really go out there and work their asses off and tell a good story as opposed to the guys who couldn't. And, you know, I was just on like this kind of mission where I just wanted to prove, if nothing else, you know, if I wasn't even going to get the push or, you know, whatever, I just was kind of on a mission to prove that, you know, I wasn't just a body guy. I was a guy who could get it. You know what I mean? And I think everything just kind of fell into place in that last year. I think I just really started to understand the business better from a in-ring standpoint. You know, I started understanding kind of the art of telling a story, and it was kind of like my outlet every week. So I just really enjoyed. I can just remember specifically one time Michael Hayes in 2009 had criticized my selling, saying that I sold like an old school, wrestler. And, you know, I kind of took that criticism and, you know, I went to the drawing board and I just kind of wiped all my memories of pro wrestling out and just kind of went back to the drawing board, and I approached my in-ring work differently. I just kind of took everything. I just started believing everything that happened in there. It's like if somebody hit me in the back, like, okay, well, how would this really hurt or how would this feel? And, you know, I just kind of got myself emotionally invested and, you know, my selling came along first. I think my selling became my strong point if you watch a lot of those matches within the last year and a half. And then as time went on, I just started looking at the puzzle. It's like, okay, my selling's getting better, but, you know, my babyface fire is still not seeming right, you know, or not organic. So, you know, I worked on all those little aspects of my game, and I just really felt like it started really coming together, and I felt like I was on my way to being one of the best in-ring guys in the company.
You know, it's funny that you had mentioned Michael Hayes, of all people, came up to you and said, you're selling too much like an old school wrestler. I would never have thought
from him, right?
Yeah, I'd never have thought, oh, that's a bad thing.
Well, you know, I think, no, it's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, we're just in a day and age where, you know, they're trying to really break the wrestling thing. And, you know, they want everything to look real. And, I mean, as much as that might sound funny, or some people might, you know, like you're saying that they're wrong, I mean, it really actually helped me stop thinking about the fact that this is sports entertainment we do and just approach it with a little bit more realism. You know what I mean? I just felt like I needed to kind of, you know, not think, you know, I mean, because the goal is, you know, when you're going out in sports entertainment, is that at this point, everybody knows it's a show. But if you can get people involved in the match, if you can get them emotionally invested in you, which was, you know, it comes a lot of time for me because I didn't have a lot of TV time under my belt. But, you know, if you can really get people to believe you're hurting, then, you know, they'll get behind you. And, you know, that was part of the fun of the whole thing. But, yeah, I mean, don't take it the wrong way. I mean, it was just more like, you know, sometimes you got to think more in terms of realism, you know what I mean, and rather than rest. Because you get, you're in the bubble. Sometimes I feel like, you know, we're all in the bubble so much, you know, even, you know, yourself, journalists and everything. And it's nice to see, hear an outside perspective of what they is real or what just looks like a wrestling angle or a wrestling sell.
It's interesting, the match I watched, I think you beat Tyler Rex every time, so I can't really tell you which of the four that it was, but you you did your big comeback at the end, and you're going for the master lock, and he's fighting it and fighting it, and you gave him the knee to the gut, and you finally put it on, and he tapped, and it's always kind of hard to tell on taped shows, you know, how much crowd noise is being piped and that sort of thing, but you can actually see people on their feet jumping up and down and cheering, because you beat Tyler Rex with this master lock. So whatever you were doing, I mean, you really got this crowd into it, and it's a superstars crowd, which can be kind of hard, you know, it's early in the show, they're waiting for the Raw show to start or whatever. It was a pretty impressive feat, quite frankly.
Yeah, it was, it was tough sometimes. I mean, even on the house shows with the lack of TV time, I mean, people remember me, luckily, and they remember the hold. So it's like, and I started to develop a little following of that. People were noticing everything you were saying. Anybody who watched Superstars was kind of noticing that. So, I was like, they were either... I got good reactions, and if I didn't, that became the challenge just to get them to care. So, I kind of really thrived under either circumstance. But, it was just, none of that stuff was piped in from what I at least for my matches. I mean, what you heard was what was actually the crowd reacting. And I think the most surprised I was when we were at the Nassau Coliseum, which I've always heard is such a rough crowd, and I remember that was just a couple months ago. And I think I was wrestling Kurt Hawkins, who's a New York native. So I was like, oh, wow, I wonder how this crowd is going to be. I might be the heel out here. And I remember going out, and, man, they really showed me some love out there. And that was one of the times that kind of stood out to me recently, where it's like, wow, they're showing me this kind of love and, not in a storyline or anything like that. And, it felt good because it's a tough crowd.
What's your first wrestling memory?
My first wrestling memory, oh my God, I don't know. There's a few that kind of jumble together. I mean, I started at 16 training, and, with Cena, we started the same day, actually. So, I mean, I got a few first memories. My first memory ever meeting a wrestler was Triple H. My first memory in the business was going down to UPW in Huntington, California, and Cena starting the same day. And, my first memory, I guess, I don't know what my first memory of WWE is. I guess my first memory of Louisville is when I missed my second TV taping and had John Laurinaitis and Jim Cornette calling me cutting promos, telling me to get my ass over there.
I'm talking, let's go all the way back. What's the first match you ever remember watching?
Oh, wow. You want to go back? Yeah, I was trying to narrow it down to the beginning. There's so many beginnings, I guess. What stands out to me is I remember, as a kid, I watched the... I think I just started getting the wrestling, and, the Warrior-Hogan match had just passed a few months prior, but I remember I was watching Superstars, I think it was, how funny as that sounds, and they were recapping the Ultimate Warrior versus Sergeant Slaughter, and they basically showed the whole match. I remember the Warrior just came out there all crazy, and Slaughter was obviously representing... this traitor to the United States. And I remember Macho Man coming out and, Warrior kicks Sergeant Slaughter's ass, bounce him around, and then all of a sudden Macho Man comes out who wants a title shot and nails Warrior with the head with a scepter, and then Slaughter ends up winning the title. I think that's my first memory because I remember as the first time I was kind of devastated by something and, in pro wrestling. Like, that really hit home to me, and I just couldn't believe it, and I was so mad at Macho Man Randy Savage. And, what can I say? I was about 8 years old,
Sure.
I remarked as a kid. But that was my first memory, I think.
I'm about, 8 years older than you, but when I was growing up, it's kind of funny reading your bio because it's like, you mentioned guys like Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, and I love those guys, and I love that style of wrestling, but... Like you, I also, early on, was a huge fan of the Ultimate Warrior, and... I don't know what it was because, you really can't have, some wrestlers more, two more different wrestlers than like Ultimate Warrior and then Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. But something about him when you're a little kid that it's just like, that's pretty cool.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you can appreciate different things for all. I mean, like Warrior obviously wasn't like a great in-ring performer, but like he made up for it so much with his, that Ultimate Warrior character, the face paint. I mean, he looked like a superhero and, but it is kind of funny that you could go from that. But I'll say from my standpoint that Warrior had fallen off the page so many times. It's just like they said in the DVD, which I watched again not too long ago, just for the hell of it. But, you know, it makes a lot of sense. It's like as a kid at that time, you know, Warrior was around, he was hot, and then he left out of nowhere. And so, you know, then you're kind of left still watching, and he's not around, and then he comes back, and then he leaves again out of nowhere. So it's like twice you're let down by the guy. And I think at that point, a lot of the fans of the Warrior did start either stopped watching wrestling, or like a guy like me, I started noticing that's kind of like right around when Shawn Michaels went singles and turned heel. And, you know, at first I just thought like the song was funny and I liked the persona change and whatnot. But I mean, you know, with time, you just see the way he'd bounce around for baby faces and he could make a match, you know, or have a good match with anybody basically. So, you know, I started appreciating different aspects of the business, I guess, as time went on. And, you know, I never really appreciated the Warrior that much more. You know, when he came back in 96, it wasn't the same for me. At that point, I had already watched Shawn work from being a tag team wrestler to going into the Iron Man match. So, I mean, I was invested in him. And, you know, Warrior coming back was cool and all. But then again, it was short-lived again. So, you know, he let me down, I think, 3 times in my childhood and once in my adult life now. So I think that's about it for me and the Warrior now.
See, now we got to talk about that. Now, if nothing else, you know, as someone who grew up as a big fan, if nothing else in your career, you got to have a match with Shawn Michaels. And we could talk about that in a second. But did you ever get a chance to meet Warrior? And what was he let down in your adult life?
Well, it was the NWA tour in Spain we did. Warrior made his big comeback.
Oh, that's right. Go ahead.
Yep. The one with Orlando Jordan. Yeah, I was there. And the thing is Warrior came out the month before and kind of put on the show for us where he's telling all the young guys that he was there to help. And he was trying to, you know, discredit all the, you know, all the bad press about him, basically, about how everybody didn't think he, you know that everybody said about him.
Sure.
So he was basically trying to wipe that reputation, and he really baby-faced everybody. And, you know, it seemed cool and all. But then, you know, come around a month later when we come back to Spain to do the tour, you know, the guy was just like, you know, come show day. I mean, I just heard of all these ridiculous demands he had. I mean, we were working a 2-week tour while he was sitting up in a mansion just working out at a gym every day. So, like, we're busting our ass, and he's making all these complaints and demands from his mansion. And, you know, so I was already kind of, like, in my head kind of like, wow, this guy is unbelievable. You know, we're freaking working every day. He's got to do one show, and he's, you know, causing trouble. And then, you know, just when it came down to show day, I mean, he just kind of came in and, you know, didn't really say hi or didn't really mingle with anybody at all. And he went out there and worked a 22-minute match with Orlando Jordan that was about 17 minutes too long. You know, he wasn't in shape. He wasn't ready. He trained for like it was a bodybuilding show. You know, he didn't spend any time in the ring or anything. And, you know, looking back, those guys should have known it should have been a 3-minute match. You know, like Orlando come in, have Warrior come in, jump, get jumped by OJ, have Warrior run a comeback, bada boom, it's over. But, you know, they ended up going 22 minutes and the fans just like completely went nuts. They were chanting circus, this is bullshit. And, you know, and then he ended up leaving without saying goodbye to anybody. And I heard he had made over like 50 grand for that one shot. And, you know, it was upsetting for a number of reasons, obviously, just because, you know, of what had happened as a kid with the guy and then to be disappointed, like I was saying, in my adult life. But also, we were real hopeful in NWE at that point that we were going to maybe have something, start up something over there because we were drawing good and we were having so much fun. We had such a great crew that we were like, man, this would be great if we could keep this going. And we were really banking on that show, and it was just such a disappointment for the 17,000 fans to, you know, be, you know, just let down so bad in the main event. And, you know, we even had to all run out there. I mean, I wasn't even fully geared up, and we had to run out there and do a schmoz just to give them a little action with the baby faces and the heels to try to salvage the show, you know, if possible.
I think the real heyday of Italy was a little bit earlier before you got there. Did you talk to anybody about what was it about Italy? I mean, it was on fire there for a while.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. I don't know if they just hadn't had wrestling or they don't get, you know, I mean, I think there's certain markets that WWE doesn't go to often enough that, you know, that are just starved for wrestling. So I don't know if that was the case or, you know, I know a lot of it, there were some weird things going on as far as they were, you know, I know that in that region they have like one wrestling magazine that sometimes blends all the organizations. So sometimes people don't know. You know, like when the NWE was coming into town, I think sometimes they were expecting to see like Rey Mysterio and instead they got, like, I forgot what the name, the guy's name was, but it was another masked guy who was basically kind of like a knockoff. So I don't know if, you know, I mean, I don't know if business went down after that because of that, or they were starved for wrestling, you know, I don't know exactly. But, yeah, it was popping off real hot for a while, and between NWE and the American Rampage Tour, I mean, that kept me real busy for my previous stint between WWE. And it's probably some of the most fun I've ever had in the business, to be honest.
So what happened that second day when you no-showed and they called to cut a promo on you?
I think that might, if you were going to narrow down the scariest point in my wrestling career, that might be it. You know, it was one of those things. I got there on a Wednesday, which is TV day, and I went straight to TV, like, this is in Louisville. I went straight to TV that day, like, basically off the plane, and, you know, I was just, hadn't even really got to settle in or anything. And then I remember every day thereafter, we had a practice and a show, a practice and a show. And it's just like, I hadn't even got a chance to unpack my bags. So come a week later, Wednesday rolls around, and, you know, I looked at the list and I didn't see my name on it. So me being as green as I was and not knowing anything really about the wrestling business besides what I had watched as a kid, I just kind of figured, oh, well, maybe I can, you know, maybe I don't have to show up. You know, maybe I can get my stuff situated, finally get moved in. And, you know, so I was kind of playing hooky, and I didn't know, I had no idea. You know what I mean? That just shows how green I was, because I had no idea. And, you know, basically Johnny, oh, go ahead, dear. Sorry, I'm driving. Johnny and Jim Cornette and Danny Davis called me, ripping me, like the loudest, fiercest, vulgar promo you would ever heard in front of everybody, too, because they always made it a point, like in OVW, that if somebody did something stupid, Danny and Jim Cornette would yell so loud in the, you know, the area, it kind of echoes, like nobody's not going to hear it, so everybody knows what's going on. So, you know, I just heard them screaming, and they had somebody come pick me up at the Suburban Lodge where most of the guys stayed when they first got out there, and I just remember I was ready to piss my pants, man. I was so scared. But I went in with a game plan, though. I just knew right away. I'm like, you know what? I messed up. I didn't know what a big deal this was. And or at least I told this to myself. I didn't tell them that. And I'm like, I better just set things straight right away and tell them I apologize. Never happened again. Because, you know, I could tell it was a big deal at that point. I just was trying to, I didn't know since my name wasn't on there, you know. But I learned real quick.
Was this in the new Davis Arena at that point or the old one?
New Davis Arena.
The new one? Okay. What were your memories of training down there? I mean, there are a lot of guys, tons of guys that came out of Ohio Valley, and you know, they'll talk about, yeah, you know, Danny and Cornette and Rip yelled at me an awful lot, but goddamn, I got good at wrestling and I learned this business. And then you'll have the rare guy like Batista that kind of came out of there and said, they did not prepare me at all for WWE. And what camp did you fall into, or was it somewhere in the middle?
Well, I think I got a good variety of people. I mean, when I got there, I had Rip Rogers, who was very old school and kind of really taught us, you know, like headlock routines and armbar routines and all, you know, all the basically kind of old school southern fundamental kind of stuff that you can work, kind of babyface heel scenarios and chain wrestling. And, you know, I mean, yeah, but he just, the thing with Rip was he ran such long practice. I mean, we'd be in the ring at 8 a.m. I mean, it was still dark outside when I was going to practice, and he'd have us practice for about 4 or 5 hours, and then a lot of times he'd actually leave for an hour to go pick up his kid while we'd be doing chain drills. So, I mean, there was aspects of that I liked and didn't like, but, you know, he was definitely a good guy to kind of get you started and kind of lay out the groundwork for you, you know. Like, UPW for me was a good place to learn the bump and to learn, like, you know, the basics. And then OVW became a place that really laid out the groundwork. And then as Rip went out, we had Bill DeMott and Lance Storm, which, you know, I kind of look at Lance Storm. Lance Storm is like he was awesome. Probably one of the most beneficial trainers for WWE, because he kind of, after training with Rip and him teaching us all, you know, the old school and all the fundamentals and laying out the groundwork, Lance Storm was more of a guy who was geared towards WWE and television and what we're actually going to be expected to do. You know, he had us work a lot more matches at that point, so we weren't doing, like, you know, 5 hours of physicality like we were doing, which I, you know, I really liked. You know, at that point, I didn't really want to, you know, get beat up for 5 hours. I just kind of wanted to try to learn the craft. We also had Bill DeMott, you know, and Bill DeMott runs his practices like a drill sergeant, and he's a guy who, I think is great for, you know, like kind of seeing if guys really have what it takes or if they really want to get into this business. He's a good guy to test them. But, you know, at that point, he had us at one, I guess I think we had bumped about 200 times. Matt Capitoli was keeping tabs on it, and I just felt like it was excessive for us because it's like everybody who was there had already made so many sacrifices. It's like, you know, you don't have to try to, you know, this is supposed to be the next generation of guys. You know, you don't have to try to destroy them. You know what I mean? So, you know, I kind of like Bill for a guy, you know, I'd love to, for Bill to be the guy they just send guys who are fresh off the street that they end up signing and put them through the Bill DeMont test. And then after that, you know, let them move forward. If they can make it through that, cool.
Now, when you're growing up, you know, a lot of people that that are just wrestling fans and, you know, they think they wanted to get into wrestling and, you know, they watch Raw and they watch SmackDown and they're like, ah, you know, these guys, they're TV stars. They get to go out there and do their match and, you know, then they go home and live in their mansions. You know, there's like this idea of what it is to be a wrestler, and it's really not like that. I mean, even in WWE, you're on the road all the time, you know, especially if you're somebody that they send out to do media. I mean, you're absolutely never home. And even in developmental, like you're talking about, I mean, these long practices, bump, 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 bump. I mean, was there ever a period when you first started out and you kind of made that transition from fan to wrestler that you just thought, man, I don't know if this is for me?
No, I never did, except for maybe one point, and that was when, you know, were bringing developmental talent from Louisville, like down, like every time WWE came down to Cincinnati you know, did SmackDown or Raw there, you know, we usually come down and work out in the ring and shake hands and whatnot. And I remember this one SmackDown I came down to, I had, you know, shaking hands in this business, obviously a big deal. I had walked into, you know, I'd shaken everybody's hand, and at one point I had walked into the locker room and, you know, I saw a crowd of guys and that were, you know, were current wrestlers up there. And, you know, I had noticed that I had shaken all their hands, so I didn't really think much of it. I went to my bag. You know, this is when I was obviously real new, so you're kind of walking on eggshells. You don't want to piss anybody off. So I'm, you know, really kind of trying to be aware of what's going on around me and whatnot. And I go over in my bag, and I guess I didn't notice that amongst that huddle was Bob Holly, and I hadn't shaken his hand, and he was pissed. And he already had a bad a bad taste in his mouth about me because he happened to be there for that practice, you know, that show we were just talking about in OVW that I missed. Oh, yeah, he was there. So he already had a bad taste in his mouth about me. So when I didn't shake his hand, he thought he took it as I don't know, either a reason to go off on me or personal disrespect, but he just completely, like, started berating me and, you know, calling me this, calling me that, and then he even tried to change. He had a match with Carlito in the dark match, and he was trying to change the match to him versus me. And, you know, just for me, it was just, it was a crazy experience because, you know, I was still I'm only a couple years into the business, and, you know, I respect all these guys, and, you know, for one of them to be so pissed at me and me not really feel like I did anything to gather that, it was just like, you know, I really went home that day because he had gone off on me so much. I'm like, wow, am I cut out for this? I mean, is everybody going to hate me? Like, I kind of thought, I'm like, if I end up on SmackDown, I might be doomed. You know, I kind of thought that might be it. I was just hoping and praying that I went over to Raw. But, you know, I mean, eventually that was all settled, and, you know, eventually he accepted me. But that was the only instance I can ever think of where I was like, oh, am I cut out for this business, or, you know, maybe I should get out.
It's almost comedy that of all the people that you didn't shake their hand, it being Bob Holly.
Yeah. I mean, well, back in the day, around that time, I mean, SmackDown was the place that kind of nobody really wanted to go to because you had your JBLs and you had your Bob Hollies, and it wasn't a welcoming atmosphere for new talent because, because these guys were real, like, kind of, you know, a lot of them were bitter and a lot of them were bullies, so... Excuse me.
Now, the Shawn Michaels match, we should talk about that. We brought it up a little bit earlier. Your chance to work with somebody that you grew up and watching since you were a little kid and just probably one of your idols in this business. And when did you first get word that, hey, you're working Shawn?
It was, I forgot where we were, but I remember, you know, it was the day after the pay-per-view match with him and Hulk Hogan. And, you know, they hadn't really told me anything. Oh, I think Sean had said something to me, but I thought he was kidding. He's asking me if it'd be okay if he was the one to break the master lock. And I was like, you know, I was like, sure, of course. You know, I was like, I don't care. I just love to work with him. And I thought he was just joking with me. But then, you know, the day after the Hulk Hogan thing is when they told me that, you know, I was going to be interrupting his promo. And, you know, I remember I was just in shock. I just was like, you know, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was like the ultimate, you know, the ultimate high for me, just because I was like, oh my God, this is like winning the world title for me, getting to work Shawn Michaels, just because I had that much respect for him. And, you know, in my mind, there's no doubt that he's the greatest performer in the history of the business. So I'm like, wow, I'm, you know, this is it. This is going to be it for me.
What are your memories of the match? What was it like?
You know, the pay-per-view match went cool. I was real happy with it. Just like, the, you know, when I went into that whole thing, I just didn't want to have any regrets. But I think the most rewarding thing about the whole Shawn Michaels program was, you know, to work him probably for the next 4 or 5 months on house shows and in Australia and Europe and whatnot. Because, I mean, it wasn't just great from a standpoint of like, oh, I'm marking out, I'm working. But, I mean, he actually, after I gained his trust and he knew I wasn't going to kill him, he started letting me call our whole matches. You know, we'd have a finish laid out, but I'd basically call the match from beginning to end. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, when you're a guy like me who's so new and you're working with a guy of his stature, it was like, even though that's how we had the, you know, he was cool with that and that's how he wanted to do it, it's like every time I'd run a spot by him in the ring, I would always kind of run it in the phrase of a question, just because I could, felt like I couldn't, like, just tell him, hey, do this.
Sure.
But I mean, he was cool, and, like, you know, our matches went real well with me calling him, and it really helped gain confidence. And, you know, I would have really probably done really well if I hadn't just kind of fallen off track after that, like, you know, and made some of the bad decisions I did and the wellness policy violations, because, you know, I had that great confidence and that great experience going under my belt with Shawn and, you know, being able to call the matches. And, you know, I would have probably been able to come a lot closer to the performer I've been over the last year back then if I had just stayed focused like I'd been over the last year and a half, you know, towards just WWE and my in-ring work. But it was kind of had some kind of distraction back then, whether it was a woman or my personal problems. And, you know, it's been a tough ride.
Now the match with Shawn, I mean, was it kind of like, was there a time during that program where you kind of thought, okay, you know, this is all awesome right now, but when this is over, I'm going to have to start working with somebody else?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, I didn't know, I mean, I don't know, it was hard to look past the Shawn thing, because to me, again, that was almost like winning the world title, getting to work a program with him. And, you know, but it did seem like for the next couple months there, they really had me in mind for something bigger. You know, they were trying me out with Cena and stuff like that. But, again, I think I kind of messed it up for myself around that point. You know, it was just more, you know, the sky was the limit at that point. And you can tell if, obviously, from that point till now, I mean, how, you know, devastating it can be if you throw yourself off track in this business, you know what I mean? Or you break your momentum, because then you're just, you either get lost in the shuffle or, you know, you're just not being used. And you had a prime opportunity there where if I would have kept it going, who knows, you know, what would have been the limit. But, you know, I know that, like, there were talks to me in the after Shawn about me working with Cena at some point, and they tried us out in some matches after Raw where we worked. And, you know, it just, I think the next thing I ended up going to, we did the Survivor Series and then the Elimination Chamber. And then, you know, I just, it was around that point where I kind of fell off track. So, I mean, that's kind of how the story goes.
Now, as it pertains to falling off track, I mean, the wellness policy is interesting because, you know, I don't want to make any accusations about anybody or anything, but, you know, when you or anybody else ends up getting popped for a wellness violation, you know, it's often where it's almost kind of secondary to, you look at, you hear that Chris Masters got popped, and then you sit there and you go, so wait a second, Chris Masters got popped, but so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, you know what I mean? None of these people got popped, and it was always kind of like, I don't know, the whole policy has always just been sort of weird to me, in that, you know, obviously in some ways it's very, you know, it's very much on the level, but it would seem also that in other ways, seems like certain people should have been popped a few times, but it just never happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know how much leniency they have. I mean, I know that there are certain things you can take that are in and out of your system quicker, so I don't know if that's how certain people got around it, but, you know, I know in my case, I think, and I have a lot of people know this, but I mean, you know, they were going to actually keep me initially, like on that last release. The first call I got was on a Monday from Johnny, and he told me I was suspended for 60 days. Don't worry about it. Just come back to work. And then I think it was, you know, Vince got a lot of heat the next day, either from Costas or I don't know if it was a conversation with Congress or, but, you know, basically whatever happened on Tuesday led to my release that Wednesday. So, you know, initially they were going to keep me. I mean, you know, I know a lot of people, kind of looked at it like it might be like I might have been the scapegoat or whatnot, but you know, I mean, just so they know, they were initially intending on keeping me at that point, and with, you know, basically told me no worries, just don't do it again.
Now, the wellness violation, I mean, you had a lot of problems during that period, and I mean, what was it that led to all of these issues? Was it kind of a culmination of just you'd been on the road a lot, all beat up, and I mean, what was going on in your life that, because it really seemed like a couple of year period where things were just going very badly for you?
Well, I got hooked on prescription, I got hooked on prescription pills is what happened, and you know, that ended up just being, it ended up being such a tough battle. I mean, a lot of people thought I was, that steroids was my problem, and, you know, they used my comeback after my rehab stint as the example. But, you know, thing is that wasn't really my problem. And the reason I had lost the weight was just because I was in a rehab running 2 miles every morning just to get kind of my endorphins going and get, bring myself back to life. But, it was more always kind of, you know, I just ran into this problem with prescription pills. I never understood addiction. I didn't even know how it was possible to be addicted. But, you know, it really caught up to me. And, you know, looking back at the situation, I mean, especially through some of the people I've known in the business, I mean, there's only two routes you can hit with that. You can either hit rock bottom or you can die. And so I kind of look at it to myself like, you know, despite, you know, the fact that my wrestling career got thrown off track and, you know, I've had so many, such an up and down roller coaster since, I'm a best case scenario because I didn't die. I hit rock bottom and I bounced myself back. And, you know, I feel like I've accomplished a lot. I feel like I was really ready for whatever they were, you know, any challenge or, you know, just more responsibility, especially within the last, just because of, you know, being 28 now and having maturity under my belt and having gone through those things in the past, like what we're talking about now with the addiction, it just, you know, you have a kind of a new outlook on life, you know what I mean? It's just like every day is a new opportunity. So, I mean, you know, I kind of approach it like that and, you know, but I mean, that's kind of what happened around that time. And, you know, it really just threw me off for a good 3 years, kind of took away about 3 years out of my life pretty much. And, you know, I ended up losing my job and ended up having to do, you know, various things. But here I am, alive and living and well.
The prescription pain pill thing, I guess really, how did that start? I mean, was it a deal where you just, your doctor was prescribing you stuff and it was very easy to get? Or in the case of like, you know, it just came out about a week ago with Jeff Hardy when he got busted with, I think it was 262 Vicodin. He had apparently been at like a WWE show, and after the show, a fan just came up to him and said, "Hey, I got some stuff. I'll mail it to you." And he mailed him a coffee can full of pills, and that's how the whole thing ended up, how he ended up getting busted. But it was just kind of, you know, when you have an addiction, it's just these pills are coming at you from all angles, basically.
Well, I mean, I had a, you know, the first time I ever tried it was in Louisville, and it was just because I had like a ruptured eardrum. I mean, I'd never really used the things, but I mean, they were hyped up down there. You know, a lot of the other guys were using them, and you started kind of understanding that, you know, that was kind of a dark side of the business. And then, you know, like I said, I just got prescribed pills a few times by a doctor for various injuries, and then eventually in L.A., ended up finding a basically unlimited resource, which was not a good thing for me. And, you know, since I've now, you know, completely disassociated with any of those resources, any of those people altogether, pretty much, because that's basically what you have to do. But, yeah, I mean, it became an issue of, you know, trying them through injuries and then, you know, passing your tick, one liking it, and then unlimited accessibility. Eventually, you know, not right away, but I mean, it takes a long time. It doesn't, you know, become an addict overnight. I mean, it takes time to build up, to kind of build to that and also to build up a tolerance. But, you know, it definitely, over the next couple of years escalated for me.
Now, when you came back, as noted, I think you said they made an example of it. What was the term that you used?
Scapegoat.
I mean, they had a, I mean, everybody remembers when you came back and Hunter and Sean were talking about how you'd lost so much weight and that sort of thing. And it was just such a weird thing on television. And, I mean, what was that entire run like when you came back after that?
Oh, you mean for rehab?
Yeah, I mean, just in general, your return to WWE after all of these problems, was it kind of like, did you feel like people...
Are you talking about in 2009 when I came back and got re-signed?
Yeah. Either one. I mean, either the rehab or when you came back. Did you feel like people were looking at you a certain way or people, you know, what was kind of the just the attitude like walking around after that?
Well, everybody was real supportive after rehab and actually pretty cool. I mean, and when I came back in 2009, I never felt like I was, people whispered about, behind my back or anything like that. I just kind of felt like I definitely felt there was less incentive to do anything with me after that. And then even coming back to the company in 2009, so I mean, it might be, maybe from a business standpoint, it just came down to, well, we don't know, this guy's a liability. He's got two strikes. Is he going to mess up? Are we going to invest all this time and money and then, he does something irresponsible, messes it up, and then we got to cut him? So, I don't really know necessarily, but I mean, that's definitely one way you can look at it from a business standpoint, I think. But, every time I've come back since I first debuted, it's been very different, So, I mean, when I first came into the company, I had the backing of everybody. And then, slowly but surely, I lost a lot of backing, I'm sure.
Now, the Master Lock, I think it was officially about 2 years before somebody broke that hold. And I think Bobby Lashley is the official first person to break the hold. There was a tribute to the troops. I can't remember the year, but a soldier broke the hold, and there's an angle surrounding it, everything like that, and it's tribute to the troops, which at the time I think they kind of figured it doesn't count or anything like that, but here it is, like 5 years later, I remember that vividly, and I always saw it at the time. It was like, I know that this tribute to the troops doesn't count, and I know this is a really cool thing to do with the soldiers there and everything like that, but I just felt like this was not the time to break the master hold for the first time, the master lock.
Well, it's funny people mention that because I don't even look at it like it was a big deal. I thought, because from what I remember, I don't remember the statement completely, but I think I kind of looked at it like I think JBL was involved somehow, so it wasn't like the troop just kind of powered out of it. But I guess just from a title of troop breaks the master lock, maybe it just doesn't sound good or it's not a good idea, but I don't know, I've been asked that a few times, and I don't know, I just don't really see the big deal in it, really.
I think it's just part of me is like, I think it's so rare in wrestling today to see something go on for so long. You know what I mean? Like the Undertaker streak is obviously something it's legendary now because it's been, 18, 19 years or whatever it's been. And I still remember to this day, I don't know if you remember this, but when Ludwig Borga pinned Tatanka, such a wacky thing, but Tatanka had been undefeated forever and they were pushing him forever as being undefeated. And he finally gets pinned. And it's like, I still remember that today. I was a little kid when I saw that. And there's something about
Master. That's so funny you say that, because I was thinking about that, and I couldn't remember Ludwig Borga pinning Tatanka, but I did remember the undefeated streak at Tatanka, so I think you kind of caught that point in time right where I had my 2 or 3 year hiatus from wrestling, my only hiatus, because I stopped watching, I think, right around the end of 92 for a little while, for whatever reason. I don't know, stuff happens in life, you change or whatever, but...
Yeah.
So I missed that Ludwig Borga thing because I was probably like in 93 and I just haven't watched it back yet or something.
I don't know. I think it's just something like that where like you would use the master lock over and over and nobody ever broke it. And then I'm sitting here watching this show and it's like, hey, the master lock just got broken, And I knew it didn't count and I knew it was a feel good thing and everything like that. But there was just something about it. It's like, I still remember that to this day. A soldier broke the master lock for the first time.
Well, then it obviously was a silly decision. If I mean, if you're still remembering it, then it probably was a silly decision looking back. When you're actually with the company, I mean, stuff moves so fast to talk, like look back at something like that and be like, oh, that was a huge regret. Just because, to me, Bobby one stands out more to me as the official one, and I just don't take that one serious. But, then again, I, you know, hearing your opinion on that, that it still stands out to you as a memory, obviously kind of makes it a bigger deal. Like, hey, it probably shouldn't have been done, you know, bonehead decision on the company.
Now, I don't, I think the final week of your WWE career, or at least the last run, I think that like on the house shows, didn't you have a couple of victories over Jack Swagger at the house shows that week?
Well, you know, it's funny because in 2009, you know, I went through this thing where they having me lose every week. I was just jobbing every week. And I didn't mind that. I mean, I was just kind of like, all right, you know, if they want me to lose every week, fine, but I'm going to go out there and I'm going to try to put on the best match possible with the most credible finish. And then as time went on and they started noticing, it actually started turning around. And then, you know, Hunter had some conversations with me, and then they started having me win every match basically on Superstars. So it was, you know, and then a lot of the matches with Jack Swagger on the house shows. So, you know, I was starting to build some steam. I mean, I wasn't on the main show yet. I was still dithering on Superstars, but, you know, I was building momentum. I wasn't losing now every week. I went from losing to winning up until my last two matches, in which, you know, like the last match I had with Jack Swagger, I was going to go over. And then the match was changed in the ring. The referee actually communicated us to change the finish.
Really?
With Swagger going over. Yeah, but that wasn't the first time that's ever happened either. You know, you were talking about the Tyler Rex matches. Believe it or not, I think we wrestled about 4 weeks in a row, and I think two of those matches were changed in the ring, too, and they said, Master's over, Master's over. So, you know, it wasn't like that was the first time that happened, and they had switched finishes before in the ring, and you know, I don't know how many people know that that happens. And, yeah, so.
Now the switching the finish in the ring, I mean, well, let's just take the Tyler Rex, take the Tyler Rex feud, for example. I mean, in your opinion, when they do the switch in the ring, do you think that it's like, okay, we want Tyler Rex to go over in this match, they're watching the match backstage, and it's just very clear that you know, now is not the time to put Tyler Rex over, so let's change the finish. Or do you think it's a deal where, all right, let's every now and then just, I want to throw these guys a curveball. I want them to get their match already, and I'm just going to throw them a curveball and see how they react to the other guy going over. Or do you think it's a little of both?
It's so funny you ask that, man, because that question will just drive you crazy because, you know, the first time they did that to me with Rex, I didn't know what to feel. I mean, part of me was kind of like offended because I was thinking, I'm like, well, what, do they think I can't call a match on the fly? You know what I mean? Are they kidding me? Like, and then part of me was like, oh, well, maybe it's Cena because I know Cena had it in for Rex a little bit because he just, you know, he was giving him heat about his work or whatever. But, you know, it really just came down to the end of the day. I couldn't, like, keep spinning my wheels over this and drive myself crazy. I mean, all I'd ever hear when I came to the back is, oh, it's a Vince call. It's a Vince call. And, you know, I didn't know if it meant is because, oh, you know, we just want Masters to win or if it was the test Rex or if it was this or that. But, I mean, I'll tell you, it'll drive you crazy at the end of the day. And the same thing with the Swagger match. I mean, but, you know, now it's a lot more in question, obviously. But, like, I remember when they had switched the matches on us in the ring, you know, and then we went on with the match and the match went real well. We had about, like, 17 minutes to work with and we had a pretty decent match. I think it was good. And, you know, after the match, you know, I remember just thinking to myself again, you know what I mean? Because I was in that spot again, but this time it wasn't like switched to me going over, it was switched to me losing. I'm like, oh man, should I read into that at all? And I'm like, and then I was like, well, you know what? The match went well. I've been consistently delivering. I've talked to Hunter a couple months ago about him and Vince being approving of my work and how much I've progressed and talking about a fresh coat of paint and whatnot. So I just kind of felt like, all right, you know, well, I'm not going to read into that too much, you know, no big deal. Like, you know, everything should be fine. But then, you know, it turns out I get released five days later. So, you know, then looking back at it, it's like, well, wow, did they know while I was out there with Swagger? Was the decision made? Just cut him? And then, you know, almost makes you want to watch the match and be like, oh my God, what did I do in that match? It was so bad.
What spot should I never do again?
You know what I mean? But I watched it back and, you know, the match was a good match for, like, you know, Swagger, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, the question you just asked me is like the million-dollar question, because that's the one that'll make your head spin and drive you crazy, and, you know, I try to just put myself past it at this point.
I just remember when you got cut, looking back at the Alsha results and seeing you getting these wins and just thinking, okay, they just made that. I mean, just out of nowhere, they had to have made this decision. Because, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, with like, you know, Melina. You know, I'd heard dating back to, like, January that, you know, this
girl... Yeah, there was some build-up for that. Yeah, there was some build-up to that. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's why I felt like it was the most controversial of the releases. And I think from what I hear, I mean, that was the reaction amongst a lot of guys backstage, just because, you know, everybody had seen how hard I was working. You know, I was just doing everything right. And then for me to get released got a lot of people nervous. You know, I don't know if it, you know, what's that thing where maybe we'll, you know, releasing Chris Masters will shake things up, or it's just a thing of we can't figure out what to do with him at this point, you know, because they had spent a lot of time, you know, keeping me out of relevance. You know, I felt like kind of towards the end there, I was like WWE's best kept. It's like, you know, like a portion of the audience knows that I've come along greatly and that I can go and, you know, I can deliver it out. And, you know, like, I'm a different person. I was trying to evolve every aspect of my game, but, you know, the bigger audience doesn't know yet. So, you know, I was just kind of waiting for that opportunity for them to give me somebody I could go with and put in, like, a good 2-segment match. You know, like, I don't even need to go over. Just let me go out there and freaking, you know, show them what I can do and see if, you know, I can get some love.
Couple of last questions here, and then we'll talk about the future. I wanted to ask about Kurt Angle. I know you had a chance to do some matches with Kurt. And, you know, there are people that, I mean, some real big names that have said, you know, Kurt Angle is the best worker I have ever stepped in the ring with. And obviously he works a specific type of match. And I mean, you got to go, 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 go. What are your memories of matches with Kurt?
Oh, his intensity is off the chart. I mean, he's got it all, man. He's an amazing athlete. He's got that intensity that comes from deep, deep within him. And, you know, he's just so gifted, man. I mean, is there anybody who's ever picked up on sports entertainment quicker than him? Think about it, you know. But I would definitely put him in a top five, you know what I mean? If not a top three, you know, somewhere in that range are probably best guys ever. You know, I definitely wouldn't put him in the 30s or whatever he was on the WWE list.
Yes. Now, the I mean, just getting in there and you know, getting a chance to work with him. This was in, I guess, around... Actually, this was probably shortly before he ended up leaving the company. I mean, was there ever... I mean, you know, when he was walking around backstage or getting ready to head to the ring, were you ever kind of looking in his eyes going, I'm not sure about this match tonight? And then, of course, he goes out there and he's Kurt Angle or anything. I mean, did you ever see any signs or anything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were times, you know, because I was going through around that same time, the same problems he was, and there were times where he was just as incoherent as I was. But Kurt Angle is one of those guys who, right when his music hits, I mean, it doesn't matter what's going on. I mean, he turns on. So he's just like one of those rare breeds. He's a machine. Like, he could do probably anything he wants in his personal life and still go out there and tear up the house, where, you know, not everybody can do that. So, you know, I know that... you know, I was never as, you know, you talk about looking into somebody's eyes, and the first person I think of is Benoit, because of the intensity of his eyes always made me uncomfortable. So that's what led, you know, and that's a completely different topic altogether. But, you know, with Kurt, that, you know, that's just how I feel.
So, actually, let me just ask you about that very quickly. So you could look in Benoit's eyes and his intensity would make you uncomfortable. You know, when that whole thing went down, I mean, there was just tons of guys that said, oh, you know, we never saw it coming. And obviously, feeling uncomfortable looking at somebody, you don't expect them to do what Benoit did. But were you one of those guys that never saw it coming, or when it happened, were you kind of like, well, you know, maybe people...
Well, I never saw him murdering his family necessarily or anything like that. But as soon as we got the news that all three of them were dead, you know, it didn't really... I mean, I automatically thought something had gone down with him. I mean, I don't know. I feel like I might have been one of... I don't know if I was one of the only ones. Maybe not a lot of other people were out about it. But I know there was a couple of people who were saying, and maybe we're rushing this tribute show a little quick, just... You know, I thought the same thing. I'm like, you know, well, what are the likely cases here? Is it a home invasion? Somebody came in there and took out all of them? Or did Chris just snap? I mean, he just wasn't a guy who really got in on the jokes. And, you know, he just, like I said, he had this intensity about him in his eyes that was just kind of like, whoa, dude, you know what I mean? Like, chill out, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, but I mean, I don't think anybody could have said they would have saw that coming, you know what I mean? Because he didn't come off as this... you know, aggressive guy that would just harm anybody, or, you know, just, you know what I mean? You just, I don't know if anybody would be able to see that coming out of somebody, to be honest.
Now, you showed up at SummerSlam this year. And did you get any sort of reaction from WWE for this appearance, this surprise appearance?
No, I don't know how they thought about it, but, you know, I figured, you know, they're in my town, and, you know, I wanted to start shooting, like, some Masterpiece Theater footage, kind of, you know, collecting some of the stuff I do on, you know, outside projects, independent wrestling and whatnot, and I figured, you know, what a great place to start. And, you know, also I always feel like, you know, WWE never kind of gave me a launching pad to show off my personality or anything. It's like, you know, a lot of people just think I can freaking bounce my chest or, you know what I mean, or think that's the limit. It's like, no, I have a personality. And, you know, that was a big part of what I was trying to convey through going down there and just told me. I just figured, let's bring a camera, let me mingle with some people and, you know, create some ruckus and see if we can get anything out of it. And, you know, we did. I felt like it was an entertaining little piece and, you know, kind of motivated me to want to do more. You know, just because, like I said, I mean, I don't feel like I got much of a platform the second time around. I felt like they started talking to me about a push or this and that, but, you know, I still feel like from the minute I got back in 2009, you know, despite how hard I worked or anything I was going to do, they just weren't going to do anything with me, and the proof, I guess, was within the last month, you know. So I might be better off actually not being with them now. Maybe I can be actually utilized somewhere else.
You know, in my opinion, I don't think you should downplay the peck bouncing, because I remember years ago there was a skit on Raw where they did musical chairs with Ric Flair, and it was like the greatest segment of all time. And I just remember watching it thinking, only Ric Flair could make musical chairs as awesome as this segment. Like, if you put anybody else there, it would be stupid. But it was Ric Flair, and he made it great. And you and the peck bouncing, there have been a lot of guys over the years that could bounce their pecs, but the look of intensity on your face, the concentration when you were doing the peck bounce in the Ozzy Osbourne skit, I thought that was just so awesome. And it seemed to me the thing that the fans saw that, and it was kind of like, hey, this Chris Masters guy is pretty cool.
Yeah, but I mean, that was a touchy thing, because then it became like, then WWE wanted me to just do that.
That's all you were supposed to do, sure.
Yeah, it's like, no. Like, you know, and that's never what I intended. When I, like, we talked about me going babyface after that, but I just kind of figured maybe we can tap into my real personality, like the guy you saw in the SummerSlam Invasion video, not a guy who's going to just bounce. You know, don't rely on bouncing his tits every week. You know what I mean? I'm like, that's not the deal. So, I mean, I did everything I could. I mean, it was a good little stick for a couple months, and it turned me babyface. But, like, if you any match you watch of mine in the last year, you won't see me do the peck downs once. You'll only see it probably in my Titantron, which I even wanted to change, just because I didn't want that to overshadow my work or therefore limit me to a comedic wrestler, because I felt like, you know, I'm like, man, I can go, you know, I got the tools. I can go farther than this. So, you know, I liked it, but I was trying to get away from it. I was just trying to strike the right balance, man, and it's tough in that situation, because you don't really, you know, you don't really know what to do in that spot. You know, you don't know, like, what do you give that to him, or do you just stay away from it completely, or, you know, do I need to turn heel now in order to get any kind of steam, or what is it?
It's almost funny, because it's like Truth is having the same problem now. It's almost like in WWE, if you are funny, you know, you want to hide that, because when they find out you could do something that's funny, all they want you to do is the funny thing, and then you're just a comedy guy. You know, it's kind of like what happened with Truth. I mean, I was waiting for Truth to get a shot, and, you know, I think he does good promos and everything, but, I mean, as soon as he started doing the little Jimmy thing and he started to put some comedy in, it's like now all they want to do is have him be a geek.
Yeah, and you don't want to beat stuff into the ground either. I don't know. I just kind of felt like with certain things, we start beating into the ground when you're doing the Master Lock Challenge again, or you're doing another, like, you know, the WrestleMania peg dance this year, I was just so not in favor of. I was just like, are you freaking kidding me? It's like, you know, I've been on Superstar so long working my ass off, and what my big reintroduction is bouncing my chest next to Yoshi Tatsu, to audition for Snoop Dogg. It's just like, how dumb. And you know, they just beat stuff into the ground sometimes, man. It's like, people don't want to see that every week. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it was funny for Ozzy, it was funny for then, and yeah, maybe every once in a while you bring it back, but man, I, you know, I wanted it to be kind of a launching pad into, you know, me, people seeing who I am, which is kind of like, you know, a guy who, yeah, I can be I can be cocky, but it's in an actual likable way. And that's kind of what I gather from that SummerSlam Invasion video. But it's just like, you know, WWE never tapped into that, man. And, you know, that's unfortunate. But, you know, maybe one company's loss can be another company's gain, you know?
One last question here. Your Superstars run, you got a chance to do a lot of matches, a lot of long matches. How fulfilling was that to get to be able to do, a 15-minute match as opposed to a two-minute Raw match? And do you feel that the opportunity to actually do long TV matches in front of a crowd, as opposed to a house show, this is actually a TV crowd where they're there, they paid their money to come see a TV show, and you're getting to do these long matches. Was that kind of something that you feel was like a big deal in terms of your work improving over the last year or so?
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, and it just made me understand how I can have so much fun working, just working in the ring, you know what I mean? Outside of, you know, everything, the showbiz part of the business and all that, which has been such a huge part that I've liked over years, that's where I really developed my passion for the art of working in the ring. And it was so much more fulfilling for me to work a 15, 17-minute match than it is to work a 5-minute or a 4-minute match, because, you know, you can really go out there and, you know, that's when people's best work comes out, because, you know, once you're about 10 minutes into a match and you've worked up a sweat, you've been hit a few times, you know, you've taken some abuse and your wind is up, I mean, that's when you start believing it yourself and you get emotionally invested, and then the people feel that and they get into it, and it's just like, you can't have that. I mean, I think I've done a good job about making the most out of those 4-minute deals on SmackDown, like a couple I've had with Drew McIntyre and stuff. But I mean, you know, it's all about those. You need to have that time, and those 2-segment matches just really, it just really became just the most fun I've ever had. I mean, it was my outlet every week. I mean, I'd be like, you know, oh, what is it? 2 segs with Drew McIntyre? Let's do it. You know, 2 segs with Dolph Ziggler? Let's do it. You know, I mean, it'd just be like, you know, it's like I'd rather almost do that than be on. There's more fulfillment out of that than being on the big show. I mean, you want to be on the big show, and, you know, you want to be, you know, have a good angle or a good spot. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to just be the guy who has to go out there in a 4-minute match just to make somebody look strong for the pay-per-view that's coming around the corner again for the, you know what I mean? Because it's always derived around that. It's there's 30-day pay-per-view cycles, and, you know, maybe a reason nobody's getting built is because you build a guy and then you sacrifice him to this guy to build him for the pay-per-view.
Let's talk about some plugs. I know you've got Twitter and some upcoming dates, and I also want you to get a chance to get your email out for bookings. So floor is yours.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can follow me on Twitter at WWE Master P. And, yeah, I know that needs to be changed to all of you out there. So, yes, I know, and I will. And let me see. As far as for bookings and bookings and interviews, et cetera, you can reach my booking manager, Vess, at masterpiece83@gmail.com. And as far as upcoming dates, I'll be down in Philadelphia. Well, I'll be in Vegas this weekend for the Mr. Olympia, shooting some Masterpiece Theater coverage probably. And I think there'll be some WWE people there, so maybe we can make some memories. And then I'll be heading off to Philadelphia. We got a wrestling convention up there, so if you're in the Philly area, look that up. It's the following weekend. And then in October or November, I'll be heading to Mexico. I think that just got posted online, but I don't have all the details on that stuff. But you'll definitely, if you follow my Twitter, you will get all that.
So I just got to mention this before we go. As far as your Twitter and changing it, there's at least one guy who was on NXT, and he had an NXT Twitter, and he changed it when he moved up to WWE, and some fan came by and just snatched up the NXT Twitter that he had and posted some very lewd tweets, and that Twitter is still linked at WWE.com. So you might
wanna... my God. So that's something to watch out for. Maybe I shouldn't switch the name. Yeah. I'm getting a lot of heat from the tweet world. I got at least 5 people every day asking me, like, hey, when are you going to change your name from WWE Master P? You're not company anymore. And I'm just like, it's not on the top of my list of priorities at the moment, but I'll get there.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the story there. I want to thank you, obviously, for doing the show today. It was great. And best of luck with everything. I know you've got some stuff coming up, and God knows, you know, perhaps back in WWE at some point. And love to have you back on again and talk about more of this stuff. And again, best of luck.
All right, man. Thanks a lot for having me.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. We shall talk to you again after a while.